The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This evening and tomorrow evening, the Lord willing, on the subject of the 70 weeks. That doesn't mean that I'm going to speak for 70 weeks, but it may seem to you that that is the case. In the first year of Darius, this revelation was given to Daniel. The time of the exile had about come to an end, and Daniel, as he tells us, was concerned about this matter. He had been studying the prophecies of Jeremiah. He tells us in verse 2 of this chapter that God would accomplish 70 years in the destruction of Jerusalem. Daniel, therefore, turned to God in prayer with supplication, fasting, sackcloth, and ashes, and besought of God information concerning the situation. What was to be the future of God's people? The exile was the period of God's wrath and indignation against the Jews. But this exile would not last permanently. Now that it was about over, what was to happen? What was God going to do for his people? When would there be a deliverance? And in this prayer, this beautiful prayer that is given in the ninth chapter, Daniel acknowledges and confesses the sin of the nation. And he identifies himself with that nation in the sin. I believe that Daniel is the only man in the Old Testament of whom no sin is recorded. It is sometimes said that Joseph may also be placed in that category, but I think there is question about that. At least of Daniel, no sin is recorded. But that certainly does not mean that Daniel was a sinless man. For in this prayer, he gives expression to his sinfulness. What is God going to do with this nation to which confusion of faces has come? What will be the future? It is while Daniel is praying that the angel Gabriel is sent to him, and the angel brings to him a message. A message, I believe, that has to do with his prayer, that tells him what is going to happen to Jerusalem and to the nation. A message that centers about the fact of redemption. And that is contained in these four verses which conclude the chapter, beginning at verse 24, and I want to read those to you now. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city, to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks, and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Now there was one commentator who spoke about these four verses as the dismal swamp of Old Testament criticism, which meant that he found them very difficult to study. And I would like to say by way of introduction that they are difficult. And there are many questions that arise in connection with them, which I think we must leave unanswered for the simple reason that we do not know the answer. I'm afraid of anyone that is too dogmatic in studying a passage like this. And what I want to try to do tonight and tomorrow night is to bring out what seems to me to be the central meaning of the passage, also to discuss it in connection with the parenthesis view of the church. The other day we considered a passage which was regarded from the dispensational standpoint as the most important passage in the New Testament, and surely this is the most important passage in the Old Testament to support that theory. If we can understand this passage aright, then we have an answer to the question of what the prophets were speaking. And so I shall make references to that view as we proceed. If you look, however, at these four verses, I think even on a superficial reading, you will see that verse 24 stands as sort of a heading. That gives us the general theme in one verse. And then beginning with verse 25, certain details are set forth. Now, I want to take this 24th verse up in some detail tonight because it is essential to an understanding of the whole thing. And so the first sentence, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. They are determined in order to accomplish certain purposes. Six of these purposes are mentioned. For example, to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity. There are three of these purposes. The period of the 70 weeks, then, is decreed or set aside for a specific purpose, to accomplish these six things that are introduced here by the word two. Now let us look at it a bit more closely. The first two words are translated in the English 70 weeks. All through this series, I've been trying to get slip across without anybody noticing it a few plugs for studying the Hebrew language. I'm afraid I can't get by with that tonight. You'll probably notice it. If we were to translate these words literally, we would have to change the order and put the word weeks first. The two words here that are rendered 70 weeks have the same consonants. Now, Hebrew was originally written only with consonants and without vowels. You can see that that would be difficult. If you take the English consonants BK, what word does that stand for? Does that stand for book, or does that stand for bake? And just get a combination of consonants, and you'll see the many possibilities that there are for inserting vowels and coming up with different words. In the Hebrew, then, originally you had only consonants. Now, if you were to go to Palestine today, to Israel, and pick up a newspaper that was written in Hebrew, you would find that that newspaper was written only with consonants. And that is quite difficult to read. The Arabic language, a sister language to Hebrew, is the same thing. It has only consonants. And the vowels are inserted there by means of little signs. In the Hebrew language, vowel signs were introduced in the Christian era in order to ease the pronunciation and also to preserve the pronunciation. But originally, there were no vowel signs, and all you have here are consonants. And the first word would be pronounced Shavuim. The second word is pronounced Shivim. And you can see, if you just take the vowels away from that, that the skeleton that remains, the consonants of each word, are the same. The first one is our SH. The second one is roughly equivalent to V. The third one is a consonant called Ayin in Hebrew, which we're unable to pronounce. And the same is true of the second word. So the first two words, as far as the consonants are concerned, are the same. The second word occasions no difficulty. It is to be pronounced Shivim, and it is the ordinary numeral 70. The second word simply means 70, and we don't have to say anything more about it. But the first word does occasion some difficulty. It is translated here weeks. Now, the Hebrew word for week is really a passive participle. I have to apologize for even thinking about grammar. We're not supposed to do it. But I'm afraid we'll have to do some of it if we want to understand this passage a little bit. The ordinary Hebrew word for week is really a passive participle, which means divided into seven or be sevened. Now, I don't know whether the word beast sevened is in the dictionary or not. It ought to be if it isn't. It's a good word because it brings out what these consonants express. That which is divided into seven. That is the ordinary word, Shavuah, and it forms a plural, Shavuoth, which is a feminine plural. Now, the word that is used here is not a feminine, but a masculine. If it were the ordinary form, you would expect it to be pronounced Shavuim. It is pronounced Shavuim. And the ah sound there is a vowel, which in the Hebrew language is naturally long. That means, and my friends, you'll just have to take my word for this. Afterwards, if you want to get into this in a free-for-all, I'll be willing to go into the grammar in more detail. But the fact that you have this vowel here, Shavuim, instead of the word being pronounced Shavuim or Shavuoth, means that it is actually a different word. It is not the ordinary word for weeks. It is an unusual form. And what it really means is that which is divided into seven. I think we may translate it by the word sevens. And so you come up with this construction, sevens, even 70 of them. Or to put it freely in English, 77s. Why would anyone translate this weeks? That is the common translation. Well, people realize that there is difficulty here. And those who translate this as weeks, right away take that in a figurative sense. There are some, very few, who say that it means an ordinary week of 7 days. Somebody sent me a mimeograph paper by a man who had been at Wheaton College, I believe, and had advanced the thesis that this meant a week of ordinary days, so that the entire period of 70 weeks would be about a year and a half in length. And I believe that some German scholar wrote his doctor's thesis to show the same thing, but I don't know of anybody else that really holds that view, because if you say this only refers to a period of about a year and a half in length, it doesn't really fit into the context very well. It doesn't make much sense. Almost everybody then says, no, these are not ordinary weeks of 7 days. Well, then what are they? They go back to the beginning of the chapter where there has been mention of 70 years. Now, I do think that this does reflect upon that phrase 70 years. But we are told in most commentaries that these are weeks of years. That is, each week, instead of being 7 days long, is 7 years long. And if there are 70 of those, you get a total of 490 years. Consequently, I think the most common interpretation is to say that this is a period of 490 years from its beginning to its conclusion. Now, I would simply call your attention to the fact that the ordinary word for weeks is not used here. Rather, it is simply a word meaning sevens. Sevens, even 70 of them, are determined. That, it seems to me, is the force of this. What then is a seven? How long is that seven? Well, now here we cannot be dogmatic. And if some of you want to say that the seven is 7 years long and the entire period is 490 years long, I can sympathize with that, although I think there are great difficulties in adopting that view. I do not think we can tell how long the seven is. I think that this does reflect upon the 70 years of the exile, and the 70 times 7 would be a period that would remind us perhaps of 490 years, but it is not precisely that. In other words, I do not think that these sevens are given to us in order to enable us to measure the length of time. They are indefinite numbers, if you will. All we are told is that there is a period of 70 of these sevens. It is close enough to the 490 so that when the fulfillment comes, men will recognize it, but it is not precisely 490 years. Now, in a few minutes, I think I can support that by further argumentation. You'll see why I'm adopting this position. The verb that is used here is in the singular. And that means that the subject is really a collective. So if I might paraphrase it, I would say that a period of 77s has been decreed. Or I might also say sevens, even 70 of them, this period has been decreed. The verb means that it has been set aside. It has been determined, that is, by God. For it is God who determines the times and the seasons. And this particular period, the precise length of which we do not know, but which is simply characterized by this phrase, 77s, this particular period of time has been decreed by God. And that is the first thing that Daniel must know. Now it has reference to Daniel's people and to his holy city. It has been decreed with reference to his people, that is the Jews, who then are in bondage, at that time are in bondage, and also with respect to his city, which is holy, that is Jerusalem. Now Daniel in his prayer had prayed concerning that. What will be the future of the Jews? What will be the future of Jerusalem? During the exile, we know that the land of Palestine had suffered because of poverty. Jerusalem had been in ruins, had not been completely rebuilt. We know that most of the Jews were there in Babylon. They were out of their own land. You can see that a devout Jew would be greatly concerned as to what was to take place next. And so God is giving this gracious revelation that this period of time has been set aside. It is a particular period of time. It has reference to Daniel's own people and to his holy city. Now there are those who say that because that is so, that it is concerning his own people and his own and the holy city, Jerusalem, that therefore it has no reference to anything else. I cannot see that that follows. That is sometimes used as an argument for saying that what follows will take place during a millennium and have reference only to the Jews. I do not think that is the meaning of the language at all. I do not think that Gabriel means to say to Daniel, this period has been determined by God with respect to the Jews and Jerusalem and has no reference to anything else. After all, these people at that very moment were in bondage, you see, to Babylon. They were had dealings with a Gentile nation, and so their very fortunes are bound up with other people. It is true that the heart of this message answers the question, what will happen to the Jews? But their happenings do not occur in a vacuum. They occur in connection with other nations also. And so while the heart of the message does refer to the Jews and to Jerusalem, that certainly does not exclude reference to other people. It is then with respect to thy people and thy holy city that this period has been decreed. Now it has been decreed or determined by God for the accomplishment of specific purposes. And there are six of these that are mentioned here. Three of them, the first three, are more or less negative in character, and the last three are, I would say, positive in character. Now there is some textual difficulty with respect to some of these words that are used here. The first one, to restrain the transgression, to imprison the transgression, it might be rendered, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity. You will notice that in those three, the words sins and transgression and iniquity are used. In his prayer, Daniel had said, we have sinned, we have transgressed, we have done iniquitously. By bringing those three words together, Daniel is simply setting forth in its fullness the nature of that which has separated man from God. He is speaking of sin in a complete sense. Sin means a rebellion against God. I'm more or less appealing when I say that to the etymological background of the word. The word that is used seems to have reference to a political sphere, first of all. It refers to rebellion against a ruler. on the Assyrian inscriptions, there are a number of statements to the effect that a certain person has sinned against the ruler. That means he has rebelled against the ruler. And while this word often seems to have the connotation of missing the mark, I think the other is not entirely lacking. At any rate, it is sin here in a moral sense. It is a rebellion against God that is in view. The transgression likewise seems to have come originally from the same sphere, the political sphere, but it refers to the breaking of God's commandments. The transgression, the walking across, as it were, the shattering of God's law, and the dealing iniquitously, doing iniquitously, is simply another word for sin, for dealing in that way that is unjust. So we have sin set before us in its fullness here. The purpose of the decreeing of the 77s, then, is order in order that sin may be removed. If you look at this 24th verse, you will see that the transgression is to be shut up, to be so imprisoned that it will never come forth to be seen again. Now, what transgression is referred to? That is, of course, the question. To make an end of sins. What sins are referred to? To make reconciliation for iniquity. There, the infinitive that is used is an infinitive that literally means to cover over. And what it implies is that an offering has been made, a sacrifice has been made, so that the sin is covered over and no longer seen. I believe that these three statements have to do with the putting away of sin. What sin is that? Now, there are those who tell us that it is the sin of the Israelites in particular, and that that will be done during the millennium. But is that really what Daniel is talking about? I think there is a passage in the Epistle to the Hebrews which reflects upon this when it says of Christ, "Now once in the end of the world hath he appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." That, it seems to me, is what is intended here. It is the very pinnacle, as it were, towards which the Old Testament points, that sin shall be removed. In the Garden of Eden, man transgressed. And before God drove man out of the Garden of Eden, he gave this announcement to the serpent, "And enmity will I put between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and his seed. Thou shalt, and her seed, thou shalt bruise his head, and he shall bruise thy heel." In other words, this enmity is to culminate in a decisive blow, in which the seed of the woman will bruise the serpent's head. And all of the Old Testament points forward to the time when that act will be accomplished. That is the great goal of the Old Testament, looking toward the fullness of time. The prophets who were given worked upon the foundation of Moses, but they looked forward to that time when God would send that one who would heal the breach between himself and man. It is that that Isaiah speaks of, and Jeremiah, and I believe Daniel also. This is the great question in the Old Testament. When will reconciliation be made? When will God show his face again? When will this breach which has separated us from God be healed over? And so Daniel is here telling us when this is to take place, this thing for which the people long, because of their sin they are in bondage, they are in exile. When will this occur? I think that it is that toward which this prophecy, like all other Old Testament prophecies that speak of the future, is looking. There is then a period of 77s. This has been determined by God. This has reference to thy people and thy holy city. And it has been determined by God so that these things may be accomplished, the putting away of sin. But now we have only looked at what we may call the negative aspect of this. There is also a positive aspect to consider, and that is given in the last three statements of this verse. To bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Let us just take those one by one. To bring in a righteousness of eternity. That is on the positive side. That is one of the results which will be accomplished by the setting aside or the determination of the 77s. That is one thing that the 77s are going to accomplish. They are set aside, they are determined, so that this may be accomplished. Now, what does it mean? The bringing in of eternal righteousness. You might say, in place of the sin that has been imprisoned, shut up so that it will no longer appear, there is introduced, there is brought, literally, there is cause to come, lahavi, there is cause to come a righteousness of olamim, of eternity, of the ages, if you will. Now, just what does that mean? What is righteousness? This righteousness that is brought in. It is a righteousness that is brought in through the 70 weeks. They are determined in order that it may be brought in. A righteousness that is eternal, that is of olamim, that is of the ages. All right? What is that righteousness then? Well, I think that when we look at the New Testament, we have the full answer. But even the Old Testament speaks of the righteousness and salvation of God. Isaiah speaks that way. This righteousness and salvation are tied up together, and they are God's righteousness. It is not a righteousness that sinful man can somehow produce. It is a righteousness that has to do with eternity. It is similar to the sun of righteousness that rises with healing in its wings. It is that righteousness which God Himself provides. And I think the Apostle Paul in the Epistle to the Philippians really brings out the meaning when he says, that I might be found in Him, that is in Christ, having a righteousness, not my own which is of the law, but the righteousness of Christ. And again, Paul brings it out when he speaks of the gospel and says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation. For therein is revealed the righteousness of God from faith unto faith. There's a beautiful development in Paul's thought there. There is, first of all, this grand declaration, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And then Paul gives us the reason why he is not ashamed of the gospel. For it, that is the gospel, is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. Then he gives us the reason why it is the power of God unto salvation. For therein is revealed the righteousness of God from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now I think that is the righteousness of which Daniel is speaking here also. You may remember Martin Luther's comment on this verse in Romans. There was a time in his life when he dreaded this verse, when he greatly disliked this verse, and he did not like to think about it, because he thought that the word righteousness spoke of an attribute of God, God showing himself to be righteous in the condemnation of the sinner. Now it is perfectly true that even in the condemnation of the sinner, God shows himself to be righteous, but that is not the meaning of this verse. And happily, Luther came to understand it differently. The righteousness of God is a righteousness that comes from God. That is the righteousness in which Paul would stand when he would appear before God. Not his own righteousness, a righteousness that would be obtained by trying to obey the law. For that could never produce a righteousness. But it is a righteousness that has a heavenly character, a righteousness that God provides. And so here, although all that is not stated, this is no earthly righteousness. It is not a righteousness that the Jews could somehow produce by repentance of what they had done in their sins. It is rather a righteousness that God Himself provides. There are so many tie-ups between the book of Daniel and the prophecy of Isaiah that I think here also there is one of them. And we can really have an understanding of this phrase by looking at some of those statements in the book of Isaiah in which righteousness and the eternal salvation of God are tied together. And so there is the introduction of righteousness, the righteousness of eternities. Now, I personally feel that this one phrase, really helps us rightly to understand the three that have preceded. I think this shows without a doubt that the 70 weeks point forward to the time of Christ, that this righteousness has been introduced by Jesus Christ. It is not a righteousness that is to come in at some future time, for Christ has brought in this righteousness. And the wonderful characteristic of the gospel is that not merely that God tells us that our sins are forgiven and then refuses to have anything to do with us, but that we are clothed with a righteousness, even the righteousness of Jesus Christ, and upon the basis of that, God tells us that our sins are forgiven and looks upon us as clothed in Him. There is then an eternal righteousness which these 77s are set aside to introduce. Then if you look at the next statement, to seal up the vision and prophecy, I think this has often been misunderstood. The Hebrew simply says to seal up vision and prophet. Not prophecy, but prophet. To seal up the vision and the prophecy might give the impression that this was to accredit the prophecies that had been uttered. I do not think that is the meaning of the passage. Rather, it is to seal up vision and prophet. Now, vision referred to one medium of Old Testament revelation, and prophet referred to the mediator who set forth the revelation of God that came to him through vision. We have been discussing this in the past days, that the God made his ways known unto the prophets through dreams and visions. And there are visions in many of the prophets. The vision was characteristic of the prophet, and the term even came to have a general sense, so that a long prophecy such as that of Isaiah bears the heading, the vision of Isaiah. And there the word practically means the revelation. And again in Amos, the words of Amos which he saw, and the word saw there is the word that is related to the word for vision. And so this came to characterize the means of Old Testament revelation. This is to be done away. The vision will no longer be given to the Old Testament prophet. The prophet himself is to be done away. For the prophets, as we have said, were simply types. They were there under Moses as a witness of the things to be spoken of. They were not an end in themselves. There is not to be a renewal of the Old Testament age with prophets again. But the prophets belong to that age that has passed away. They were forerunners of Jesus Christ, who is the great prophet. And when Jesus Christ comes, we no longer need the vision. We no longer need the prophets. Now it is perfectly true that you do have prophets mentioned in the New Testament, and I am well aware of that. And you do have perhaps visions. Paul had a vision. But that is something quite different. Those were gifts which accompanied the apostolic age, the founding of the church. They belong to the period of fulfillment. That is not what Daniel has in mind here. That is not the Old Testament age. The Old Testament age is the age of vision and prophet. And that is now sealed up so that it will no longer be seen. It is done away, for something new and something better is to come. And then the last statement that is made here is to anoint the most holy. Now this is a difficult phrase. Literally it means, and to anoint. And the Hebrew word Mashiach, to anoint, reminds us of the word Messiah, Mashiach, to anoint a holiness of holinesses. That is the literal translation of these words. That means to anoint that which is most holy, or to anoint the most holy thing. Now what does that refer to? Well, I want to say very frankly, I do not think we can be dogmatic on that. There are differences of opinion. I think we are justified, perhaps, in interpreting this phrase in the light of the other five. And if the other five refer to the messianic work, it would seem that this does also. And I can have great sympathy with those who believe that this refers to the anointing of the Messiah for his work, the descent of the Holy Spirit upon him. But I'm not going to say that in any positive fashion, because We simply do not know. I think the only thing we can be sure of is that this phrase is included with the other five and would seem to have reference to the same work. But literally it is simply to anoint a most holy thing or a holiness of holinesses. And that, I think, is all that we can say positively about it. We have then, you see, in this 24th verse, this truth brought to light, that God is going to bring redemption to His people. He is going to remove sin, and He is going to introduce eternal righteousness. And the Old Testament age will pass away. And in order to accomplish that, He has determined a period of 77s. If I understand this text aright, it means that this period has been determined by God for the purpose of accomplishing these things. And when these six things have been accomplished, then the purpose of the 77s will have been fulfilled, and they will have come to an end. Now, right away, someone is going to say, when did they begin and when did they end? There's one thing I think we can agree upon. We have to agree upon it, and that is that nowhere in the text does it tell us where they ended. Well, where did they begin? Now, if you go on to the 25th verse, you will see that they are divided into three groups. And so verse 25 says, and thou shalt know and understand from the going forth of the word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince is seven sevens. There is one seven set out as the first part, and then 62 sevens. And those are two sections, you might say, of the entire period of 77s. Then there is also mention in the 27th verse, and in the midst of the seven, which refers, I think, to the last or the 70th seven. Now, they begin, it would seem, with the going forth of a word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Thou shalt know and understand is equivalent to our Lord's words, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Let him hear. It would seem to imply, you see, that a spiritual discernment is found in Daniel, and Daniel is to pay attention to this. He is to know and to understand from the going forth of a word. Now we have time tonight just to say a little bit about the beginning of this period. In the King James Version, we read from the going forth of the commandment. And that is a very unfortunate translation because the Hebrew simply says the going forth of a word. If you will look back to verse 23, you will see that it starts out, at the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth. Now, this Bible has a little five before commandment, and in the margin it says Hebrew, word. It's the same as the expression in verse 25. At the beginning of thy supplications, the word came forth. That word came forth from God, did it not? Simply a word, not a commandment. And this language in verse 25 is the same from the going forth of a word. And the content of the word has to do with the restoring and the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Now, many commentators believe that they must find a commandment to return to Palestine and to rebuild Jerusalem. There was a German scholar of the last century named Ernst Wilhelm Hengstenberg, one of the greatest Old Testament scholars, I think, that Germany has ever produced, and a true Bible believer. He was converted in early life when he went to teach Arabic to men who were going out to the mission field. Then he plunged himself immediately into the study of the Old Testament. And he has written as full a discussion of these 77s as anybody that I know. He has over 200 pages on these four verses alone. He has worked it out that the commandment refers to a period in the life of Artaxerxes, a Persian king. And he dates that at 445 B.C. Then you see what he wants to do is to get 490 years in there and work that up until the conclusion of the whole period. Now, it does not work out very satisfactorily. And as you know, Sir Robert Anderson of Scotland Yard wrote a book on this subject, beginning at the other end, as it were, beginning with the month Nisan of the triumphal entry, and working back, he came to the year 445. But he insisted upon certain presuppositions that every month had to have so many days, that there could be no extra days in any of this reckoning, and you had to begin at a certain time and work back, and that way he believed that he had worked this out mathematically. Now, I frankly think that kind of thing is wrong. I do not think that this passage was given to us in order that we might be clever with mathematics and so on. And I'm not impressed when every now and then somebody comes up with long tables to show that he has worked this out right down to the dot. In every one of these cases, certain things have to be granted in order that all these mathematical calculations may work out. I think we get much farther by looking at what the Bible itself says here. The emphasis of the Bible is not upon the end of this period, certainly, because that's not mentioned. The emphasis of the Bible is not upon the beginning of this period. The emphasis of the Bible is upon what is going to be accomplished by this period. And that's where I want to place the emphasis. Now, God evidently sent this word forth, and the content of it was to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And I am inclined to think there is only one period in history when such a word went forth, and that was the first year of Cyrus, which was 538 or 39 B.C. And if you add 490 to 539, you do not come up to the time of Christ, which is another reason why I do not think 490 precise years are intended. Now there is this threefold division. The parenthesis view of the church maintains, and I can do a little more than state this, and our time is about up. We'll have to plan then to continue tomorrow night. The parenthesis view of the church maintains, or most of the advocates of the view maintain, that this period begins in 445 before Christ. You have the period of the seven sevens, or 49 years, which roughly covers the work of Ezra and Nehemiah. I agree with that interpretation. Then you have the period of the 62 years, which they claim brings us up to some period in the life of Christ, possibly the time of the triumphal entry. Although even the Scofield Bible, I'm very glad to notice, says that we cannot be precise upon this. I forget the exact language, but the prophetic language, it says, is so close as to show what is intended, and yet not precise, so it will stifle idle curiosity. It's something to that effect, it states, and I think that's a very wise note. But according to the dispensational view, 69 of these periods have been accomplished by the first advent of Christ. I think it is fair to put it that way. Then the last period, the 70th seven, was not fulfilled immediately. But rather there is the great gap, the great parenthesis, and at the close of that, the 70th seven will come. Now, let me just state it a little more fully in order that we may do justice to this view. We today, in this church age, according to the parenthesis view, are in just that, a parenthesis. This age will come to a close when Jesus Christ returns for his saints. When he comes for his saints, the 70th week, or 7 of Daniel, will begin to run its course. The Jews will be regathered in Palestine. They will make a covenant with the man of sin for 7 years. In the midst of that week, that is, after 3.5 years, he will break the covenant. There will occur a great tribulation lasting for 3.5 years, and at the end of that period, Christ will return with his saints. They make a distinction between his coming for his saints and coming with his saints. Following that, there will be the 1,000-year reign, the period of the millennium, and after that, the judgment of the great white throne. The nations will be gathered together for battle at Armageddon, and then the eternal states will begin. Now, that is one presentation of this parenthesis view. I want to present the view that the 77s are a unit, that just as there is no gap between the first period of 7 and the second period of 62, neither is there a gap between the second period of 62 and the last of 1. I think there is a reason for that division, which we'll have to let go till tomorrow night. If there is this gap, now this is just a consideration, I'm not going to call this an argument, But if there is this parenthesis, notice this. This parenthesis of the church age has already lasted nearly 2,000 years. That is four times longer than the entirety of the 77s themselves. Let me state that again. The parenthesis view is that the 77s last 490 years. Between the 69th and the 70th, there is a parenthesis that already has lasted nearly 2,000 years, or four times as long as the whole 77s themselves. Now, just keep that in mind. Then this second consideration. There is no gap between the first and the second periods. Why should we assume a gap between the second and the third period? There, it seems to me, are considerations that are worthwhile keeping in mind. But may I close by saying that as we turn our thoughts away from some of these considerations, I believe God has given us here a look into the future. Rather, he gave Daniel a look into the future, an assurance that the salvation would come. He tells Daniel what will happen to his people and what will happen to his holy city. He tells Daniel that this period has been determined in order that the promised work of salvation might be accomplished. And there, I think, is where the emphasis should fall. Thank you all very much.